are going to start, even though we don't have a quorum, we have an extremely busy day. Do we have... Good morning, we are covering details about this morning because we're going to do three things. We're going to hear a bill from Representative Saylor. We are going to hear from Bowser about clean water, and then we are going to take the next step in hearing about the natural resources land report. Members probably know that we got our targets, and Mr. Reinholz, will you just tell folks exactly what our target is and our tails target?
Madam Chair, members, general fund target that was given for the Environment and Natural Resource Committee is a reduction in the current biennium of $16,300,000 and a reduction in the 12-13, which was the tails, of $12,500,000.
It's a lot of reduction. What the process will be right now is... since exactly no one has come to me with suggestions for reductions, the chair will put a chair's proposal on the internet sometime tomorrow during the day, and we will hear the bill on Thursday. We will pass it out on Thursday, so we are in that kind of timeline. So, any questions that folks have after they see it, any changes, please come and visit because we want to go as fast as we can. So, with that, we welcome Representative Saylor. Welcome to the committee. I can't move your bill because we don't have a quorum yet, but I will move it for possible inclusion in this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have an amendment that I would like to adopt. Do you want to wait until you have a quorum?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Go ahead and start talking to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We'll just explain the bill. This bill is one that was brought to me by the Cross Country Ski Association, who works very hard all around the state with the volunteer groups that maintain the cross country ski trail system throughout the state. And it's their work is funded by the proceeds from the Cross Country Ski Trail Pass. And as costs that these volunteer groups incur keep going up, they want to be sure that they can keep these trails out in good working order for people to use, and again as part of our state tourism as well as healthy exercise. But we have a few testifiers, just a couple today, and so I would like to ask Darby Nelson, who is the who actually is the original author of this bill, to say a few words to you about this.
Well, certainly welcome to former Representative Nelson. Okay. Welcome
Thank
to the
you,
committee.
Madam Chair.
Good to see you here this morning. I think I saw you here last night, too.
My name is Darby Nelson. I'm on the Minnesota Nordic Ski Association board, the organization that has brought the bill before you. I'm going to make a couple of comments. I know you've got a very tight schedule, and we'll try to make this as quick as we can. First off, the as Representative Saylor indicated, the fees that we pay for cross-country skiing are dedicated monies back to the grant and aid program that the DNR runs, and the money is funneled into quite a large number of organizations across the state through townships, counties, or cities. And I would, first off, I'm gonna let John Munger, who will follow me, talk a little bit more in detail about why the fee is needed and so forth. But let me just call to your attention, in your packets should be a sheet of paper that will identify for you on the one side a map of the location of all of these groups that receive grant and aid money at the present time. I think it's something like 42 or 43 organizations, and you see they're scattered well across the state from Cook County all the way down to Maurer County and near the Iowa line. If you flip that page over, you'll then see the names of the clubs and the sponsoring organizations, again, typically counties or what have you, as well as some financial information. So at any rate, that's useful, hopefully useful information. The other thing that I wanted to do is to identify for you the number of these clubs who have sent letters to us in support. I'll just go very quickly through this list. Minnesota Nordic Ski Association, as I said, was the entity that brought the bill forward. In support, then, include the Duluth Cross Country Ski Club, the Bemidji Area Ski Club, the Brainerd Nordic Ski Club, the City of Lakes Nordic Ski Foundation, the Mora Vasalopet, the Northern Lakes Ski Club in Itasca County, the Itasca Tour Ski Bike Run Club in Park Rapids, the Nordic Ski Club of Central Minnesota at St. Cloud, North Star Ski Touring Club in Minneapolis, and most recently a letter from the Minnesota Finlandia Community Health Sports up in Beltrami County. So it is broadly supported by skiers. When I brought the bill, or carried the bill back as a freshman, we basically said, we skiers really enjoy our sport. Grooming trails is really an important part of that. And we know there's no money in St. Paul, so we're simply asking you to allow us to pay for this through a vehicle that has some organizational credibility to it. I know that John Edmund is here. I want to make just a quick comment about the tourism issue. He will certainly be in more detail about that. But in the last week and a half, I spent a gorgeous Saturday over at Hayward, Wisconsin, skiing in the Birkebeiner ski race. And you need to know there were 8,000 people there, and Sawyer County counts on millions of dollars coming into the county, businesses and so forth, as a result of that effort. So it's not just lone folks going out and doing skiing. It does have some fairly significant, or can have some pretty significant tourism and economic impact. With that, I think I'll...
While you're coming up, we do have a quorum now, and I will move House File 3207 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill and move Amendment A 102284, which is the author's amendment, to get it in the shape that the author would like. No questions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment has been adopted, and the bill is before you, members. Aye. Welcome, Mr. Munger. Do you have a few words you want to say about the bill?
Exactly. Thank you, Madam Chair. John Munger, with the City of Lakes Nordic Ski Foundation and the Minnesota Nordic Ski Association. Also with me today are my assistants, Ellie and Lauren Munger, and I think Lauren has a possible something to include in the record, a picture of a skier over there, so if you want to see it. I want to tell you about what the grant and aid system does and what the problem is here today. So the grant and aid system, all it is skiers buy a ski pass in order to have the privilege of skiing on ski trails that are groomed. It's $15 currently for a year. The bill would raise that to $20 for a year. So it's a small increase. The problem over time is that the 725 miles or 1,200 kilometers, if you're here, of trails that are groomed in the state cost quite a bit to groom, and those costs have been going up over time as grooming has become more complicated. As some of you might know, cross-country skiing has evolved over the years. It used to just be the classical style skiing. Now you have the skate style skiing, and that creates quite a bit more cost in terms of the grooming. So you have just kind of the inflation costs and then also the more complex grooming over time. So those costs have become so great that the cost of maintaining those trails can't be kept up with the past. You have about $225,000 or so that comes in each year through this and then is redistributed out to those clubs. And you can see when you look at Darby's list of the clubs, that the division makes it so there's not a lot going to each club, and just maintaining the equipment alone you can't keep up with. And so that's why the ski community has said, geez, we're going to really start losing trails, we're going to start losing the quality of our trails, and we're going to lose people going out skiing, which is a loss for everyone in the state, especially when we're dealing with the kind of healthcare crisis that we are now, where people are less and less active, and so if you don't keep up your trails, you have even more problem with that. In a state where winter is long, and even now is still has our teeth in us, so that's why we're looking to have the trail pass fee increased. And I guess if you have any questions, I'd be happy to hear them. Otherwise, Mr. Edmond can speak about the tourism impacts.
Let me ask one question just to think about. You said the fee raised was to $20. It's to $19 in the bill.
I wasn't aware of that.
Okay. But let me ask you about another part. I can see the wisdom of raising the fees for folks who are regular users, but as you want to bring people into the sport and to encourage them, the proportional increase for the daily pass is higher. At least compared to the 3-year. So it would seem that you might want to think about that daily pass and its relationship to the other pass. I mean, I think personally, I hope your bill passes, but that's one thing I would be thinking about. You don't have to decide today, but I'd be thinking about that.
Madam Chair, just for purposes of clarification, I think I kind of glossed over that. The $15 is actually an annual pass fee currently, not a daily. I think the daily right now is $5, and it would go to $6. So it's for the daily fee is not actually much of an increase. It's the annual pass goes from 15 to 19.
In the bill, the daily fee is from 5.
I'm sorry, this is what?
This is our
term. Pardon me? In the amendment?
This is this year.
The daily fee is from 4 to 5, not from 5
Thank
to 6.
Thank you.
Oh, Madam Chair, I just want to clarify as well on some of that. The difference is when we're seeing like $14 versus $19, that's because it doesn't reflect the fee that's charged while they're doing that. That, and so I know that's ended up with all sorts of confusion with people who are used to saying, well, this costs, you know, $5 or it costs $40. That's simply because when the bill was drafted, we were told that they wanted the exact amount for the fee, not the recording fee, if you will.
Leaves the proportional question out there even more because it's a flat fee of the dollar. Is that, am I getting that correct?
You know, the daily pass is supposed to be just that $1 change from $5 to $6. And that was in the original bill as well.
Madam Chair, if I may, there is certainly a proportional increase. What happens is that this is a step increase over time, so you know you don't come back and inflation adjust this every year. So it's been, I don't know, 6-7 years since this has been changed last. and during that time, you just fall further and further behind, so you have to have some kind of a beyond inflation adjustment when you get there. And just for perspective, you know, if you go to a private ski place and you know, want to go on a ski at Lutzen, it can be in the neighborhood of, you know, $12 or $15 for one day to ski. So this is still a great deal. I mean, you go to Lifetime Fitness and pay $60 a month, and here you can, for the entire year, ski for $20. So it's, I think, not a real grave increase on people.
Well, I think that we can hear very quickly from tourism, and then we will lay this bill over for possible adoption.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Edmond. I'm Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. And to respect your time, I'll try to be very, very brief. And I just want to make the comment that this is part of tourism. It's why people come to the state of Minnesota. We're an $11 billion industry, and 24% of all that economic impact is in the winter. And cross-country skiing is certainly a part of that mix. 6.3% of all Minnesota's residents participate in cross-country skiing, and they includes about $41 million in trip spending and $3.9 million in local taxes. And you've heard from the ski associations why it's important. The money goes to the trails, but it's important. I guess I also want to speak for the average recreational user of cross-country skiing. It's a modest amount, even with the increase, for people to come and enjoy the sport of cross-country skiing. The little mini focus groups that I've done with not the avid skiers, not the ski club members, just the recreational users, when you tell them what the fee is to cross-country ski in the state, even at these amounts, it's incredibly modest for the experience you have in enjoying Minnesota resources. So this is very appropriate from a tourism viewpoint, and I do feel that cross-country skiing, we have to do everything we can to maintain cross-country skiing in Minnesota. It's important. It's a great part of the state of Minnesota. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I don't see any questions. Thank you all for presenting, and we'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And now we will welcome the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. Members, if you remember, they received a fairly substantial amount of the Clean Water Fund, and that's what we're going to hear about this morning.
Madam Chair, members, John Jesse, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. Ms. Blackford and I are going to tag team this morning, and in your handouts, I believe you've got a copy of the presentation. This is going to be a summary of a report that was submitted to this committee and others on March 1st, which has the details that lay out the way we carried out the funding, as the Chair mentioned, in terms of the appropriations that came to our agency. As well as a few additional pieces of information. So I'm going to kind of cover the overview of the processes and the way we got that selection of projects, and then Ms. Blackburn will talk about the projects themselves and some of the expected outcomes from those projects. This slide you see here lists the appropriations in total. That was $18 million. You can see there's a number of subdivisions to this funding. That was, I think, important to focus what each of these particular grant items was for. We also had some ability then to shape the funds to the projects. Some projects were eligible for more than one fund, perhaps, and we, through this competitive grant process that I'll describe in a moment, we were able to get people to just give us their application, their best projects, and we would work with these specific funding sources to match up the outcomes the project was aiming for with the funding source. We developed a competitive RFP, which we published and announced October 15th, and that RFP was open for a period of a month and a half. Before we did that, though, we had to establish criteria upon which the projects that were going to be solicited and then selected were going to be based. And we used this quantitative scoring system to lay out what we were expecting for the projects and then the criteria upon which we would use to make the selections. The first one, these qualitative factors, that one, you know, is the most ambiguous, but also in some ways also pretty important because it allows us to understand how the project is connecting to the citizens in the community, something you maybe can't do in a real quantitative fashion, but nonetheless important to to get the people connected to what their dollars and their local governments are proposing to do with these new funds. The second, the water quality outcomes, that's very specific. You know, that's basically the pollutant reductions or the removal of a threat that we can quantify in terms of the benefits to the water body itself or to a downstream receiving water body, lake, river, stream, wetland, et cetera. The third criteria was the prioritization in a plan, the local water management plans that have been prepared by counties, watershed districts, and stormwater conservation districts have had, you know, the ability to connect the scientific data to the people in the community. We wanted to make sure we honored those plans. Certainly, the TMDL plans in the case of restoration were also a key part of making the selection, and the prioritization in those TMDL plans is also factored in where we could. Of course, we don't have TMDLs in every part of the state, but many more are being developed each year. The fourth criteria was readiness to proceed. You'll see that we ended up selecting 42 projects. We have a long waiting list of projects that didn't get funded that were certainly good ones. And so if any of these projects, for whatever reason, aren't ready to proceed this year, this construction season, we will, through the work plan approval process, move to a project that's third on the list and defer the funding for that project to a subsequent year. We want to make sure we're getting these projects going as soon as possible. Now, the fifth criteria was the augmented funding. We were looking to see projects bring in funding from other sources, from federal, local, and private sector sources, non-state sources. And so that was a 10% or 10 points in this case added to their application. The long-term benefit, you know, this is aiming at the sustainability. We want to look for projects that have a good design up front so that the long-term maintenance and upkeep of those projects is minimal. We also look for a local project sponsor, a local government, so we have someone who can, you know, be the project owner for the long term so that the investment we make here is going to carry forward for many years. And the last one, we know that there's a provision that requires a connection to groundwater planning in many of these projects, and we also acknowledged a 5% or 5 points for that particular item. On the next slide, you can see it's more of a diagram. This shows the process we used. As you know, we cannot use this fund to supplant funding that we already have in place from other sources, the general fund in our case being the primary one. But we also don't want to create redundant systems, right? We want to be efficient with our systems. And so we created this process that we basically put these two funding sources into a single process with discrete accounting, let's put it that way. And so you can see that even before this process began, as I mentioned, on October 15th, we had a number of outreach sessions. We had an academy up in the central Minnesota area where we had several hundred local governments come and understand what we were looking for and how we were going to proceed. We established a blog on our website, and then we developed a kind of a running questions and answers series along with that so that when we answered one question from somebody, we could provide an answer to many, you know, as the process unfolded, so we could get everybody a fair chance to understand the priorities and what we were looking for. So you can see here there's these two categories of funding. We did the RFP on October 15th, and that was through December 1st, and we wanted to have, if at all possible, the grant awards occur very early in the calendar when we were told the money could be made available. So that was the earliest we could make the money available, so we backed up our process to accommodate that schedule. And you can see that there's a number of steps along the way. The main one that occurred in January when our board made the recommendation or reviewed the recommendations that have been provided by a staff and the board committee to select these 42 projects. And so this is the process we used. It was all the projects were evaluated based on merit, as I described in those criteria that we established. We used an interagency group of professionals to initially review those projects and rank them, and so that was the steps along the way that led to our decision in January. I should also mention that it wasn't tied into this directly, but certainly we got some questions about it when we helped the University of Minnesota conduct the listening sessions around the state over the months of January and February as they put together their framework, which they'll be bringing to you in less than a year now, I guess. So that was the process, and what I'll have Ms. Blackburn do is just give you a little bit more specific information about some of the projects that were selected in its initial first year of funding.
Good morning. Julie Blackburn, Assistant Director for the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. And first of all, I want to apologize for the very small print in the handout of the presentation. We just simply can't make copies of the entire presentation, every slide. It's just kind of a bit expensive. But we do have a couple of other pieces of information that we handed out. And one is just a very brief talking point, and that's an 11 by 14 overview. And then we did hand out copies of our Clean Water Fund report, and that is available on our website as well. So that provides a lot more detail. What we're trying to do right now is highlight some of the projects that were funded, just to give you a flavor of the types of projects that were funded. And the kinds of impacts we'll see from these funds. This slide is a combination, this slide and the next one, is a combination of three of those pools of funds, what we're calling the runoff reduction, which was available to watershed districts and water management organizations, clean water assistance, which was available to all of our LGUs, and then shoreland grants. In total, for these three different pools of funding, there were 42 applications that were funded. There were a good combination of both protection efforts and restoration efforts, restoration being where there's an impaired water. These show, as John went over the criteria, extreme readiness, a lot of effectiveness, and very, very targeted. And in fact, if the application didn't specifically name a place, a landowner, the amount of readiness points were decreased by 50%. So we know that these are projects that are ready to go. Out of these three pools, there were $7 million available. Just to highlight a couple of the projects in the metro area, Minnehaha Creek Watershed District received about $224,000. This is an area in South Minneapolis that it has an extraordinary amount of citizen involvement. It is citizen-led. It's going to affect the Diamond Lake impaired water. And the citizens are ready to go. They're going to be going out there and doing their own rain gardens and putting in pervious pavement, all to help Diamond Lake and its impairment. Ramsey Washington Metro Watershed District is also to affect Coleman Lake, which is an impaired water. This project is an infiltration project, which in the metro area where we have little land left to put conservation in, that's really what it's going to come down to, is making sure that we take use of anything that we can do underground, or putting in pervious pavement in where there currently is impervious. So this is going to reduce the phosphorus from this watershed into Coleman Lake by 60%. And 2 inches of the every rainfall event that equals 2 inches, all of that is going to be treated underground. We just don't have room for stormwater ponds everywhere. Another one is the North Cannon River Watershed Management Organization. They received $150,000, and this is to put 10-year extensions on CRP. CRP contracts do expire, so at least we keep them in there another 10 years, and that's for 67 acres. Targets highly erodible land. Here's some more examples. Outstate, the Pelican River Watershed District received $250,000. This is a pretty incredible project that they've been working on for a decade. It started with some funding from the Corps of Engineers, doing some engineering and studying on this. What it does is it restores Rice Lake to pre-ditching levels. Because it's doing that, it's going to reduce phosphorus by 50% that's going into that Detroit Lakes chain of lakes, which we know is a very valuable tourism industry spot to go. Leverages over $1.5 million, excuse me. So that's a great protection effort. Wilkin County, Don Bayomba is the SWCD administrator out there, and they are just so incredibly effective in getting out there and working on drainage systems in order to reduce the impact on the water there. And so they are putting in 112 side inlet controls, 28 miles of sediment control structures, 235 acres of native buffers. Clearwater River is working on trout stream habitat. And this also, this trout stream, not only is it going to protect that trout stream, but it also helps protect Clearwater Lake and the Clearwater River, which is impaired. It treats the stormwater from the city of Kimball and will remove 90% of the phosphorus from that area through infiltration. One of them that's on the handout but isn't on this slide is down in Nobles County, where that watershed is receiving $157,000 to finalize some of the projects that were brought forward in a federal stimulus project for an impaired water. So many people came forward in order to try to work on this impairment. They had leftover projects that still needed funding. And so it's going to put in 20 sediment control structures and 8,500 linear feet of grass waterways. St. Louis SWCD is doing Knife River restoration. That's an impaired river. Putting in native buffer projects, stormwater ponds. Aitkin County is doing a protection effort. They're working in partnership with three of the other counties in that area to put in these projects, including infiltration, bioretention ponds. And in Goodhue County, it's an interesting project there. The Mineola Township feels so strongly that this is an important project that they are doing a levy match for these funds because they're tired of cleaning up the roads and the road ditches from all of the areas that are heavily eroding. And so matching these clean water funds takes care of road projects as well as all of that sediment that was dumped into the Zumbro River, which is impaired. So it's a really great project. We also put out a lot of money for SSTS and feedlot grants. The SSTS projects are going to result in inventory on over 30 lakes and 3 river sections.
Excuse me, Representative Hamilton, do you have a question here?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Are there size limitations on who qualifies for those feedlot grants?
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, yes. They are only eligible if you're under 300 animal units and in a riparian area.
And Madam Chair? And that's because by law, anything over that must be in compliance. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, I don't know the specifics about the law. What I know is that this was what was in the legislation that we had to abide by. Okay, so the SSTS projects, we're going to have an inventory of over 30 lakes and 3 segments of rivers. It's going to implement or improve the database for SSTS programs in over 14 counties. And we will resolve over 50 imminent health threat systems. Feedlot projects, 53 feedlot projects are going to be upgraded or come into compliance. And again, they are targeted to the riparian area. On the SSTS projects, there were 11 grants that go to 14 counties for the enhancement program. And in the imminent health program, those go to 11 different counties. One of them is a cluster that's in Meeker County, and that is also going towards an impaired water. And it's a partnership with the Public Facilities Authority as well. Going on to technical assistance, in this fiscal year, there was $1.25 million available. We have allocated so far $921. This was not part of the competitive round, and here's why. Last year, when the federal government through the MPCA rolled out its federal 319 program, they require a 45% local match. That's pretty difficult for our LGUs to obtain. So what we tried to do is use some of these funds to provide up to 20% of their match so that we could get those federal dollars coming into the state. This was the largest amount of 319 funds that have come. There was over $6 million that were made available to the state. So we allowed anybody who is working on an impaired water project to apply for this 20% match available through this fund. So that's how the $921,000 have been allocated. The remaining funds are still left to be allocated. We are looking at leveraging federal funds. Two of the projects right now, or two of the programs, federal programs, include the Mississippi River Basin Initiative, which was just announced, which is over $50 million per year that comes to targeted watersheds in the Mississippi River Basin. There are four targeted watersheds in the state of Minnesota. It is important to note that the federal government does not provide technical assistance for these projects. Another one is the Great Lakes Initiative, and that's in the northeastern part of the state. And again, technical assistance is very limited for these projects. So if we want those federal dollars, we need to make sure that we get the technical assistance funds to match them. Conservation drainage, there was only $200,000 available in fiscal year 2010. We received 15 applications for this, over $1 million in requests. So that's five times the amount of money that was available. These projects were reviewed by our interagency drainage work group, our drainage management team. Five projects were selected, and what they do is include culvert sizing on it on an entire drainage system in order to retain the water longer on the land so that it's not causing erosion downstream or erosion along that riverbank. Also, sediment basins, side inlet controls, and part of our program when we got these out is to make sure that they're monitoring the benefits from the conservation drainage and providing outreach. So those are all the grant programs. We also had two different easement programs that were provided through this funding. One of them is our riparian buffer easements. Both of these programs are working through our Reinvest in Minnesota program. There were $3 million available in 2010 for riparian buffers. Our sign-up began on November 1st. All of the funds were allocated by January. It results in 86 easements being obtained, permanent easements. We targeted these towards already existing CRP lands. So it, again, keeps that CRP permanent. Nine counties are receiving funding from this. More than 700 acres will have permanent conservation in place. We do have another $3 million that's available in, oops, I did an error here, sorry, fiscal year 2011, that should say on the screen. We have, however, already received enough applications to exceed the $3 million that are available in the next fiscal year. And the last funding that we received is the wellhead protection easements. We received $1 million in funding. We work with the Department of Health and the Department of Ag on these programs. It is very, very, very targeted towards vulnerable and highly vulnerable wellhead protection areas. Seven different areas of the state's wellhead protection areas were targeted, and we are working locally to try to get those conservation easements on that land. We know for sure that one or two of them is in place. $1 million will go very fast. So that is a summary of what we've been doing with the Clean Water Funds. When we say they're out the door, we haven't exactly got them all out the door yet because the work plans are still being approved, but the money is spoken for. And so with that, we would take any questions.
Super. Thank you for being concise and targeting outcomes. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to thank Mr. Jashke and Ms. Blackburn. This is excellent. I mean, this is the type of information we need. It's too bad because, you know, there are some special interest groups that said that the clean water money only was used for studies or for monitoring, and it appears to me here that all of this is our real projects, projects that are in the ground, projects that are helping identify needs. Your criteria were science-based, they were competitive in nature, and you've gotten the job done. But we keep hearing clean water was treated differently. That it was all studies, and I think that, you know, earlier I'd asked you if you had a press person or a government relations person. You said no, and maybe that's why the conservation media or some of these folks or the general public don't know the good work that you do, because you're doing the work and not worrying about telling people about the work. So I guess it'll be our responsibility to tell people what you're doing, because it's excellent work.
Madam Chair, just a comment on that. You know, we also rely on the the importance that these projects bring to the local community, you know, and so it's sometimes it's hard for the state to explain why a particular project, a particular problem is important to their community. We rely on our local governments and those people to try and do some of that outreach, and that's why, you know, one of the things that we did was to require that as part of their grant that they provide an outreach component to the people of their community about this project and other ones like it that might be needed or are forthcoming down the road, because that connection to the people and the land is really critical. And we can't always do it at the state level. We rely on local agents to carry it out on our behalf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there are a lot of really nice projects. I've got a question on the Pelican River. Ms. Blackburn, you mentioned that with $250,000, you were able to leverage $1.5 million. I'm just curious on that 5-to-1 match, how you accomplished that.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, part of this project is bringing in the federal dollars. They were not eligible for RIM dollars, but they were eligible for WRP. And so what this project does is it, in order to restore that what was a lake, they're working with the federal government to put in WRP 30-year easements in that area. And in order to then get the restoration part of it, to put the practice on the ground, put in the levees to restore that lake, they needed the practice dollars. And so they had the easement dollars, they needed the practice dollars. That's how it leverages those funds.
And Ms. Blackburn, do you know the acreage of this site? And then just other question would be, I'm assuming it's a traditional WRP, not with public access.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, I can't remember right off the top of my head the acres. And it is the federal program, and so it is the traditional WRP.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, my recollection is that Rice Lake, which is the upstream water body, that has the ditch through it, so let's say it's about 485 acres is my recollection. That lake, that Rice Lake, which is a big wetland, will be fully restored by the the undoing of this ditching which occurred. The reason it wasn't eligible for RIM is because the lake itself didn't have a cropping history. It was never fully drained, but it had been ditched right through the middle. And of course the lake's downstream that the phosphorus reduction will occur on are of course public recreation bodies, and so it's the easements will be on the lake upstream with the ditch with the ditch being undone, and the communities down or the lakes downstream will be the ones that will receive the benefit.
And I had one more, somewhat unrelated. I'm just curious, what's the unmet need based on where the bills are today in regards to RIM? And then do you have projects on the ground that potentially would not get funded and we would miss the federal match? Or do we got to go out and look for those projects yet? Or do you already know of projects more than what the amount of money that Lessard and the other pockets bonding, the numbers you're seeing now?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, we're going to undertake a sign up for RIM WRP beginning, I think, April 1st. And so then we'll collect the applications and we'll give you a specific number of, people who are interested right now in doing one of these projects that are eligible for those funds. We've talked about before, that the federal money available in Minnesota, each of the federal fiscal years is going to be somewhere between $20 and $40 million of federal money. And each state dollar is basically going to leverage $1.4. And so I can tell you those ratios. I can tell you the amount the feds will have available. I can't tell you right now how many projects we have in the hopper because we do a sign-up typically each year for a month and a half so we can get genuine interest and eligibility determined.
Just real quick, thank you, Madam Chair. If it was fully funded, do you think you'd ever be able to find enough people to actually do the projects?
Madam Chair, you're saying, can you repeat the question? I just want to make sure I understand
it. If some way, somehow, we came up with the match to get $25 million each of those 2 years from the feds, would you ever be able to find the projects for it?
Madam Chair, I'm confident we can. I guess nothing's ever unlimited, certainly. I don't want to ever think that. But we've had each sign-up we've done for the last 2 years, we've had, $125 million in applications, approximately, with a, in some cases, a 30-day sign-up, in another case, a 60-day sign-up. you know, it's a matter of how much outreach you do to get landowners to understand and put their name on the dotted line saying that they're applying for the program. And so it's hard for me to give you a good answer, Representative McNamara.
And then I'm curious, Mr. Jasky, how about the quality? Some of them I have seen are just unbelievably high-quality ones. And as Representative Hansen talked about a little PR, it would be great if we actually saw some photos of the restoration, like this Rice Lake bed after it's restored. Would you say these would be what I would think of as high-quality ones in areas that would be much better to be in a program like this than to be marginally farmed?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I mean, you know, the eligibility is it has to be marginal ag land with some amount of cropping history, because we want to be able to fully restore the basin, I guess, is to put it that way. Yes, we can provide you some of that information. The selection process is very scientific. You know, we do this in concert with the NRCS. We've got a scoring mechanism that weights various factors. You know, in this case, it's been primarily migratory waterfall benefits, but obviously there's secondary benefits, including water quality and flood control and things like that. But we've used, in the last several years, a method that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and others have developed to select projects based on those criteria.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers from Bowser. First off, congratulations on the good work that you do. I too am very impressed with how many dollars you can get out on the ground and doing projects. But my question really is around the Wellhead Protection Program. I guess I would like a little more description of just how you define wellhead protection and what science you're using to back up the efforts.
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, we are working closely with the Minnesota Department of Health, and they actually define wellhead protection in their statutes that apply to that agency. They also do the determination of vulnerability and determine which ones are vulnerable and highly vulnerable based on their own studies. And so I'm unable to speak to the specifics of that, but what I do know is that when we are targeting them, it is through some extensive data gathering about where is that vulnerability, where is the interface between surface waters and groundwaters, and where is it the quickest point of potential contamination that needs to go into conservation permanently.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and I guess I don't have another question, but just I think my questions will have to go to the Department of Health then to get more information on Director Jasky.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, I think, you know, basically what the process is, and this is, you know, a simplistic version perhaps, but that you map an underground watershed, you know, the flow pattern that directs water to this, the well, the community wells that are being protected, you know, need the protection. And that is driven by, you know, the geology principally, but also, as Ms. Blackburn mentioned, different geology has a different connection to the surface. And so we're looking at an underground watershed, in essence, and then trying to look at the risks of that landscape that are connected to that underground watershed.
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, if I could just add one more thing. Working in Stearns County for a number of years, I'm pretty familiar actually with the Stearns or the Cold Spring and the Melrose vulnerability areas. And in Cold Spring, in that granite area, there are, you know, major crevices, you know, where the geology just is basically split open, and the water just is almost directly going into that groundwater where they've already had to shut down wells because of the contamination from the groundwater. So that's just an example of the kinds of information that go into putting these protection plans in place.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to follow up on the wellhead protection, in the constitutional amendment where the clean water funds are provided, there is a carve-out for groundwater protection and for drinking water protection. Was the wellhead protection portion, a lot of the other funds or other projects that you talked about were surface water, but the wellhead protection was groundwater and drinking water, or can maybe highlight that out a little bit?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, could you ask that question again?
Madam Chair, Ms. Blackburn, I think in the constitutional dollars, we have to do surface water and groundwater and drinking water. So when we appropriated the dollars, wellhead protection is the groundwater portion, not the surface water. You have your the prior projects that you talked about were surface water related. Then we have groundwater, and then we have drinking water. But the wellhead protection was a groundwater or a drinking water project.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, yes, the wellhead protection is the groundwater protection. Many of the other projects, however, kind of are a little bit of both. For instance, some of the projects that go to Stearns County, the drinking water intake for the city of St. Cloud in that regional area is the Mississippi River, and immediately above the drinking water intake is the Sauk River. So any work that they do above that is drinking water protection, although not wellhead. In areas of the southeastern portion of the state, where you basically have whatever is your surface water is your groundwater because of the karst region, what we do it for conservation in that area is benefits both. And so some of it is absolute, and some of it is protection through doing conservation that affects all of the water. They are integrated.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, you know, I'm familiar with the Vermilion River in Dakota County, you know, where the upper reaches of that river are fed by groundwater, so groundwater is coming into the river. And then when you reach a point, you know, upstream of Hastings, near Highway 52, the geology changes and the river is actually feeding the groundwater. And, you know, on the upstream end, it's a good thing for the surface water because it's being driven by cool, clean water coming in from the ground, which sustains the trout fishery, for example. And then you get downstream, and you've got lots of land that, you know, has been developed and is utilized, and suddenly that water reaching a stream is now going back into the ground, which is affecting the Hastings well supply. So you're right, you know, we've got these criteria for drinking water and groundwater and surface water, but in reality, nature gives us a lot more complexity, as Ms. Blackburn was describing.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Jashke, you're providing protection through practices rather than purchases.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, these are practices. There are, of course, the easements are an acquisition of land rights that are basically, you know, going to make permanent contracts or practices that have been put in place by the federal government in most cases.
I'm going to ask the question I think is probably a bit unfair because your experience is new, and but as you were getting your applications and putting them out, was there any grouping of applications or maybe just individual applications that just stood out in your mind as we're going to have terrific outcomes from this particular grouping in terms of water protection? Were there any that just stood out?
Madam Chair, I guess I wouldn't say that. There was a couple that we ended up not funding because of questions about them, if you want to get into that difficult.
No, subject, no, I'm more interested okay. in the ones that you funded mm-hmm. that you thought this is going to offer this kind of project, not the project, but this kind of project is going to offer Minnesotans the biggest bang for their buck. That's what I was
saying. I think, Madam Chair, the ones, you know, using that criteria, certainly factoring in the dollar equation into the equation, I mean, that's the ones that, you know, leverage the other funding from the federal government or from some other sector, you know, the nonprofits or the local governments. And you saw the example in this case of the project that's on this description from a township of all things, a township actually putting a levy in place to support a project that they, you know, really felt was important. So those are like, that's the kind of thing, I guess, that stands out when you put it in the bang for the buck kind of criteria.
Well, let me put it a different way.
Okay.
If you just had, it's not the leverage bang for the buck, it's a whole pot of money. Were there any particular practices, protective practices that stood out for you as saying, we ought to do more of this?
Madam Chair, it's a difficult question to answer because we have such a varied landscape and such varied water resource issues in this state. I actually believe that we'll probably be able to answer that question a little bit better after these projects come forward. I think in the most simplistic way, the beauty of this process is that all of those best rise to the top because of the competitive nature of it. And so every situation was very unique, and that's why that local commitment coming from local plans where local people are bringing them forward that understand those issues, it's really up to them to figure out through their plans what is the most critical thing rather than us. And so that's why we embrace this local delivery system, because of the uniqueness of each one of those projects for that area. So I'm not sure that that we're really ready to say this one thing, because it's so varied.
Okay, it's not one thing, but if there's a practice or grouping of practices that protect the water that we should be concentrating on more, that's what I'm trying to get at. Is it buffers? Is it something else? Is there a practice or group of practices that feel like we need to rise to the top as one of the funding categories? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Madam Chair, I think, you know, just if you're going in that direction, I would say possibly you could say near water projects, you know, buffers and shoreline area, up, you know, higher in the watershed. That would be about as
higher in the watershed.
As careful as I could be about not, you know, getting specific, as Ms. Blackburn said. I mean, you could pick any one of the top projects and put it in a different place, and it wouldn't be a high priority project, you know. And so, place is so critical, as you described. But for right now, that would be our best answer, at least for today.
I'm still taken by Dr. Mullah's telling us that we can do precision conservation now, and that's the direction this state should be going in, and that's certainly what you're working on.
Yes.
Is this precision conservation, but we need to, on this side of the table, need to be a little more educated about some of those protective practices that are going to precision conservation. So, thank you for all your good work. We will be visiting again, and thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Thanks for having us today.
Next, members, we're going to have public testimony on the Office of Legislative Auditor's Report on Natural Resources Land. Some of you were at Representative Murphy's hearing yesterday or Friday at the Office of Legislative Auditor's hearing to hear the report from the auditor, and now we're going to hear some public response. We've invited Representative Murphy's committee members here, but during this hour, it's a hard hour to share because people already have other commitments, other committees. But I do want to welcome the Commissioner of Natural Resources to start, and then if there are other members of the public, I want you to make sure that you are there. Other members that would like to say something? I see one, two. I mean, you're welcome. I'm just trying to do the time here. So, okay, we'll start with the Commissioner. Thank you for coming, Commissioner. And members, there are extra copies of this up there. The pages will bring it to you. If you don't have one in your packet, that you may have found one. Representative Murphy, come up here, please. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Mark Holston, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and I want to thank you for giving me an opportunity to come and talk about the report as we did last
Friday.
I don't remember if it was Thursday or Friday at the Audit Commission. And I had a chance to listen to the presentation last night by the auditor, and we have to tell you, when we looked at this report, our basic review of this report is that the Audit Commission gave the Auditor's Office such a broad scope that the report, I think it became a very difficult assignment for the Legislative Auditor's Office to come in and try to do an analysis on land management and those programs. They ultimately narrowed in on four specific chapters. And as we look at the report, we see it as being, quite frankly, a validation of all the things that we've been talking about with you over the last 4 to 6 years. All the programs that we've been talking about, the changes that we've been looking to bring into place, as we've been trying to update our procedures and our standards, are validated by the recommendations within the report. So we see it as a fine report. It tells us that the direction we're going, the work that we're doing is on track, and we need to continue to do that. I talked a little bit about last Friday some of the complexities that, unfortunately, the report is unable to bring up. And you understand this as the Environment Finance Committee with the work that you've been doing, that when you ask the Department of Natural Resources to go in and do land acquisition, land management, we're really charged with managing that land for three specific purposes. And I talked about it this way at the audit report. For Representative Gunther, he looks at us and says, we want the Department of Natural Resources to manage that land for recreational values. Hunting, fishing, trails, snowmobile trails, cross-country ski trails, biking trails, that's what we ought to be doing. Parks. Representative Hansen would ask us to be managing that land for economic development purposes. Timber management, mining management. The economics that are generated within our society as a result of hunting and fishing. The bait shops, the sport shops, the guides. They're asking us to manage that land for economic development reasons. And then we have somebody like Representative Dill, who wants us to manage those lands for the protection, for the forest and the fauna, and protect those things and the natural resource values that those bring in.
I think you might have to switch.
Oh. The point being is that each and every one of you is not that much different than the general public. When they look at the Department of Natural Resources and they look at the decisions that we are ultimately having to make and why we make those decisions, we've shown you that graph of the three circles and how the three circles intersect each other. We're responsible for managing that landscape for three values. And those three values create conflict both internally within the agency but also externally within the public, who don't always see and understand the decisions we make and why we make them. The report, unfortunately, isn't able to pull those things out.
I need to stop you there, because I think what the report was looking at is not what you are describing right here. Because the report is looking at specific categories of land, and I don't think you would expect that a SNA, Scientific Natural Area, would be managed for mining, nor would you expect that a WMA would be managed for high science. I think Representative Hackworth would say no to that. So while we have this broad mission, we are specifically here and in the auditor's report talking about categories of land where each category is not to fulfill distinct purposes. So I think we don't want to get off base from the auditor's report. So can I ask you a couple questions?
Yes, it's your committee, but I would like to challenge you in that statement, Madam Chair. In that 86A lays out the categories of how we are to take, when we buy a parcel of land, we are supposed to cookie cutter it into 86A and the different categories of land management. And when you say a WMA as an example, we do manage that land for some scientific value, and we will look at economic opportunities. It may be more or less, but that scientific and natural resource area, which is designed more for its science, its rare and unique value, may still have recreational values. and those opportunities persist. The report points out and talks about specifically the checkerboard pattern ownership of land and the conflict that that creates in maybe not being efficient in terms of management. Well, and that's true. From a forest management perspective, logging interests, mining interests, that checkerboard ownership may be problematic. But from a recreational or a economic value, that checkerboard ownership has value also. And so it doesn't bring the multiple values into perspective in some of the decisions and some of the comments that it makes. But that's why I needed to challenge you on that.
So we'll get back to that.
Okay.
The auditor has some specific recommendations.
Yes.
Let me just ask you some questions about those, because I think that's of interest to this committee. On page 34, the auditor said that as you purchase easements, you do not appear to have a formally adopted process and criteria as a department policy. They acknowledge that you're working on proposed standards, but say these need to be adopted. Are you going to adopt them, and if so, when?
Madam Chair, as we have been talking to you for the last couple of years, specifically about easements, yes, we are developing those standards and those processes and procedures. It is a tool, and I think it's an important understanding, is that conservation easements have been a tool, but not regularly used by the department over time. It was hit and miss within specific divisions over time, and it was very scattered. It wasn't until 2004 that a national standard around conservation easements came into play. Many of the easements that we probably own today don't meet those standards that are now in place as a result of 2004. As we move forward now in 2004, those standards are put in place. The enforcement and monitoring aspects, those are coming in those processes and procedures that you're talking about that we are developing. I do have with us our easement coordinator who's managing that program, and to the specific, when are we going to be ready?
No, this is, I think you're not honing in on the same question. You have a October 2008 memorandum regarding the involvement of third parties in any DNR acquisition of conservation easement or other interest in natural resource land. The recommendation is you adopt those standards. And my question is, are you going to accept the recommendation of the auditor, and if so, when?
Which number is that?
We're on page 34.
I'm looking at my response in the written response, Madam Chair. Page 34. Yeah. Can we have a date? I mean, Madam Chair, the answer is yes, we are going to be adopting those through an operational order. The timing.
The time, Madam Chair, Susan Damon, project consultant for the Conservation Easement Stewardship and Enforcement Program Plan. We have a timeline in this plan to finalize and make recommendations for conservation easement stewardship. The final products are due June 30th, 2011, and the plan is to implement the proposals and plans that are devised during this phase of the conservation easement stewardship project. And implementation is scheduled to begin July 1st, 2011.
I think we're talking about two different things. I think you're, and I think that's something you want to get back with us on. I understand the LCCMR project that you're talking about, but I think what the auditor is referring to is something that Marty Vadas has working with specific criteria for easements right now. So I think if you can get back to us on that, we would appreciate that. Let me ask you the next one.
Okay.
On page 32, the legislative auditor says that you do not include a transfer notification provision in all of your conservation easements. I know in your response you said you were going to do that. When will you start doing that?
Madam Chair, I believe that's something that could be implemented immediately. With any new easement acquisition, there could be a change that includes that language.
And is that it's the department's commitment to do that?
Madam Chair, that, yes.
I mean, we're just, these are some of the very specific recommendations of the auditor, and I think they're important to bring up. On page 30, the auditor makes another recommendation and says that when you purchase an easement, you do not have baseline reports for what's in that land. And so the recommendation is on page 31 and says you should prepare a baseline report for all conservation easements in order to document the condition of the property at the time of the acquisition to enable meaningful and effective management. That is something you could adopt now, and then my question is, will you be adopting that now?
And sure, we'll be adopting, as we stated in our letter, the recommendations that are brought forward and that those that we agree with, we will be implementing.
I'm just talking about this specific one. Mm-hmm.
Yes, we will be implementing it.
You will be starting now?
Is that connected to the LCMR?
Madam Chair, I believe that you are referring to new acquisitions and
yes.
baseline reports. Yes, that is something that could be implemented immediately with new acquisitions, and many of the new easement acquisitions at DNR are routinely having baseline property reports prepared in connection with the acquisition.
But not only routine, but absolute for every one of them. I think that's the question the auditor has, and we're just kind of, these are important things for, as we spend our Minnesotans' money, that Minnesotans know what they're getting. And I have a fourth one. I think the auditor did an absolutely great service for the state, for Minnesotans. And so I don't want to waste the opportunity that the auditor gave us. On page 50, in future directions, there is a line on that says the state could be acquiring new land while increasing backlogs of management, restoration, and other activities needed to maintain existing land. In other words, as we go forward acquiring more land, if we don't have a plan and process for managing the old land, we might be setting the old land back further and further. So the recommendation is on page 51. It says, should, as we acquire new land, demonstrate in sufficient detail how an entity will manage the parcel to achieve specific public benefits, how it will pay for the management, and any impact the acquisition will have on the type of or frequency of management of existing lands. I think that's a question, I'm not talking about other entities, but as you go forward.
Madam Chair, this is where I think it's hard for the without understanding the breadth of lands that we're managing, from WMAs to parks, to trails, and those acquisitions, we're able to provide substantial detail in many of our acquisitions. As we move into the other, in the areas of our natural land acquisitions, the natural lands acquisitions, a lot of those details are not going to be specific on a parcel-by-parcel basis for our acquisitions. we know generally what we're looking to do, but it's when we talked, when we disagreed with our ability to provide you with that intimate information, we can by program tell you what we're looking for, what type of amenities we're looking for, and the types of management that will go in. But on specific parcel by parcel, we're not able to provide you that level of detail. We can tell you programmatically, in a generic sense, what those types of managements would be and what some of those costs could look like over time.
That rather belies one of the things that you talk about in WMAs, where you, and I don't remember the numbers exactly, but you were going parcel by parcel through the WMAs, looking at them, and you've done like 500 and you need to do 900 more. So in the WMAs, you are doing the very thing you just said you're not doing.
Well,
and I think what you were doing, what you had in writing, was the right thing.
Yeah, and I think that's what I'm trying to say, is that for management looking back, you know, members understand, you provide direction and statute for us to do management plans on all of our lands except for WMAs. Those have been statutorily not required us to do a management plan. We on our own decided that didn't make a lot of sense. We needed to start doing some management plans because of this very issue of being able to talk about what those costs would be and what our management strategies would ultimately be. So we began a process of developing largely on our major units and then starting to focus down. Will we get to each management unit, each parcel? I don't know if we'll go to that level of detail on a, we might look at it more instead of a parcel by parcel, but as a region or a complex of parcels, particularly in the natural lands in the agricultural area where we have scattered WMA holdings. We'll do it on a regional basis and not necessarily on a parcel by parcel basis.
Representative Hanselin has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Holston, I have a little different question. I think you were here when Bowser had done their presentation before your testimony today. And last Friday, Mr. Jashke had talked about their tracking mechanism and the detail, and earlier today they were able to show us, you know, where they purchased the project, the dollars that went in there, what the purpose was. And just with the cost-cutting environment we're going to be in here and tracking, is there a way where, I mean, Bowser already has a tracking mechanism for their RIM easements, and you have a variety of different other land. So I'm just wondering if there's a way to coordinate so we don't have to redo or create a whole nother process for this?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, it's not going to be so much a process as it is the investments that we're making in a land record system. One of the things that we've talked about in front of this committee for a number of years is we had a very archaic data system. Archaic may not even be the right word. It's basically sticks and stones. It doesn't work. And so we have been investing over the years into a very elaborate but very technical database system that this information can be put in so that we can draw out that information and point to those types of details that you want to see. Our management programs can then work and our enforcement plans work directly with that.
Follow-up, ma'am. I think last summer there was an CMR application to better track the WMA lands, and I think you're trying to do some things without receiving that, but, I mean, is that a very critical thing that we should be looking at funding? I mean, do you need additional support?
Boy, the lands record system... Bob, are you? Or Lori? Where are we with that? Kind of
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. The lands record system project that we have, that's in its third year of implementation, it will be up and running on June of 2011. That will contain all of our deeds, all of our information, and it will have a portal to the public as well. So that will capture part of it. The process that Representative Hansen is talking about with our WMA kind of management tool, we're trying to figure out how to fund that right now, but I'm hoping that we'll come back to the LCCMR with another proposal, work with staff to have something that may be more acceptable to members. It is important to have that, that what we're talking about is a tool, web-based tool, that our area and managers can enter data into. We can query and extract and actually have, we have a piece, I believe, on our web right now where the user can enter data. I was on X unit, saw this whatever occur or invasive species or something like that. The road needs to be fixed. There's a pothole. We can get that data as well. So getting that information is important, and we're trying to figure out how to do that the best we can.
Thank you all for your testimony. We appreciate it. We have two folks from the public that wanted to take them. If you'd like to come down. We're going to share this 5 minutes between two people, so that's 2.5 minutes.
Well, Madam Chair, members, my name is Tom Jess. I'm a private citizen from Plymouth. Representative Anderson is my representative. I got to look at this real quick. It seemed like it was a very narrow range of questions that were asked with regards to management. So I tried to go home real quick, and I don't know if we can throw this up, or actually it's on page 10 of the guide. The land holdings that you're looking at in the northern forest are mostly all tax forfeited lands. I went through and all the state forests. Their designated acres does not compare to their actual acres because there is private lands within them. There's also a few that are located either within the Superior National Forest or Chippewa National Forest. Most of those state forests were designated prior to 1963. I would have bet that it would have been Representative Munger's work that got a lot of those forests designated. 1963, there were 24 state forests designated. 1933, there were 9. Some of those were the result of either forest fires or slash fires in reading the history of these on the DNR website. They had all been extensively logged, and then state tried to sell those off, or they were sold off by private people. They tried to farm those. There were a lot of ditch bonds that were issued. You know, this is one fault that I found with the, you know, history needs to be in this. This is where I find a little bit of fault with the auditors. They needed to dig down a little bit deeper to find some things. Since we've only got 2.5 minutes, I'm a pack rat, and I have a publication, 1978. It's Our Nation's Wetlands. It was produced by several entities. But it talks about wetlands. I'm going to put some other words in here. Others see the primary safeguard against extensive future loss of public lands as comprehensible and enforceable state and federal regulations based on an understanding of the importance of those public lands to the aquatic, to the ecosystem. This view is based on the principle that society has the responsibility and the right to protect the water, including the ecosystem, from destruction and degradation for the common good, and that landowners are not guaranteed the privilege of making a maximum profit from their land if it involves the irreplaceable loss of a part of the state's or nation's resources to the detriment of all. It's a pretty powerful statement. What we're looking at, if you look again at page 10, those land holdings, we've got the Prairie Pothole region. And just about that whole Prairie Pothole region is in a lot of those 61 counties. WMAs do have a part on parcel and protecting habitat. And I think that overall, I think the DNR has done a good job, and you also have to be reminded that the amendment was passed because of the lack of funding from this body and the one in the other building. That is why the amendment came about, because there was a lack of funding for the DNR to do their job maintaining those. It had been 2% of the budget. It's down to less than 1% of the budget. They need to have, it takes money, and they need that to have the tools to be able to manage those lands and particularly safeguard those lands for future generations, not just ours, but in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we all have the same goal, and thank you for that. Ms. Garlitz? Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Annalee Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I do not know if I can do this in 30 seconds, but I will try to speak as fast as I can. I would like to begin by complimenting the OLA on doing a really good job of looking at this really complex issue. And as noted earlier with the discussion, there's a lot of other issues that this is brought up and recommendations that have been made to continue discussing these different pieces that have been brought up in this report. And AMC would like to, I would like to say on behalf of AMC this morning that we would like to be part of those and really encourage this discussion of PILT. It is a very important one to counties because it is a large portion of funding that counties do receive. One comment I would like to make in particular, something that I have heard from several counties who have looked at this is that they understand that the OLA couldn't really dig in to this particular issue about the PILT payments and the different impacts. The comment about the adequacy of PILT payments to counties. There's a lot of counties that do feel that right now they're wondering, they're looking at the amount of land that is held in public ownership in their counties, and they're struggling right now to find developable acres in those counties for different, whether it's, it could be farming areas, it could be commercial business areas, and they're looking at the highest and best use of those lands, and they would hope that that would be taken into consideration when PILT payments are looked at. And that's just something that would be a whole other report in itself, but that's one thing that had been noted. The other one that I would like to briefly comment on is very briefly in the report, the OLA mentioned new lands to be purchased through funds with the Outdoor Heritage Fund. And I've spoken with Representative Murphy's committee about this issue and AMC concerns about purchasing of new land, and would just like to note that AMC would also be supportive of having conversations of how we can, when these new lands are purchased, how do we adequately provide for the full cost of these land, which is payments, whether it's PILT or some other upfront payment or however we could work that in, and the full cost of actually managing the land. We think that all of those things need to be taken into consideration and fully support those discussions when new land is being purchased. And again, the OLA mentioned the need to discuss the unclear statute, the statutory purpose of PILT, and in the coming years, we would like to welcome the opportunity to discuss this and some of the other recommendations that were made.
Thank you. Members, I don't see any other questions or comments. I announced at the beginning that maybe we'll just review it for you now, that we got our target on Friday. We have to pass a bill on Thursday. That is this coming Thursday. Nobody? DNR, PCA members gave me any recommendations of what to cut. So the chair will put some recommendations forth and we'll post them on the website tomorrow, sometime in the morning, hopefully. And then on Thursday, we will have a discussion and vote on them. So with that, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.